Hello, everyone, and welcome to COVID-19 Questions and Answers on KASU. I'm News Director Jonathan Reeves, and for the next hour, I'll be joined by my guest, Dr. Shane Spites. He's the Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. We're talking about COVID-19, some of the key concerns related to the pandemic, and also, as we go along, we're going to be doing questions that you've submitted through email and Facebook. So let me welcome Dr. Shane Spites once again, who's joining me over Zoom today. Dr. Spites, thank you so much for your time. Welcome back to KASU.
Thank you, Jonathan. Again, I always enjoy speaking with you and listening to the questions and comments from your listeners. So happy to be here.
Since we spoke last couple of weeks ago, give us an update on COVID-19. What are you learning? It seems like you're trying to learn all the time, but even then, there's a lot that you don't know. I hope that's accurate to say.
That's spot on, Jonathan. Thank you for making that salient point. Gosh, I mean, just in 2 weeks, the amount of information that we're seeing now, and I'll just hit a couple of hot spots now in terms of kind of things that maybe people are reading in the news or certainly that we're seeing in the research. There have become more questions about long-term immunity in terms of antibodies and who's protected and who's not. There may be a possibility that the immunity wanes sooner than we thought. However, it also looks like that the antibodies that you receive are stronger. So basically, maybe you don't need as many antibodies, but they're stronger than the typical antibody that you would have when you recover from a virus. We're seeing better evidence come out regarding the use of cloth masks by the general public in public places to reduce the spread of the virus and lower infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. So we're getting better at that evidence. Here in the state of Arkansas, many may have seen the UAMS School of Public Health put out projections on July the 2nd regarding cases in the state. That obviously was, and I think, was something we're going to talk about here in a little bit. We'll dive into that data. One of the good things, children seem to actually have a lower viral load, which could translate into milder infections and actually less likelihood of actually passing the virus on. You know, we think about children being little petri dishes and just spreading viruses back and forth. This virus, of course, is different. We keep saying that. It seems like the current evidence says that children may not be as infectious as we first thought. And unfortunately, we're just now starting to uncover the long-term effects of this virus. It seems like we've been talking about this a long time, Jonathan. We're just really 5 months into this. We're already starting to see data from people that have recovered from it in the early couple of months that are having long-standing lung and heart issues, which obviously is concerning to everyone. We're not going to know the full effect of this virus for many years to come, but some of the preliminary data is not reassuring.
So by way of the surge of cases, it continues to go up in the state of Arkansas. What do you think is contributing to that? And I know it must be very concerning for healthcare professionals to see just huge jumps in Arkansas at this time.
Absolutely. It's still at this point in Arkansas, they're related to specific events. And so typically you can trace it back to communal living. Maybe it's multiple family members living in a house in close proximity. Maybe it's tied to a specific industry, such as the poultry industry or a certain plant or something like that where there's an outbreak. Maybe it's specific to some sort of setting where a community group got together. Maybe it's a birthday party or a neighborhood barbecue or something like that. We're not at this point really seeing the disseminated or the wide community spread that we can expect to see this fall and into this winter. So we are seeing cases go up across the state of Arkansas and seeing those also here in Northeast Arkansas. We can expect to see that. I don't really expect to see the significant or what we call exponential spread until into the fall and the winter period.
Now, this is not a political question, but I did want to get your thoughts on the governor has said that increased numbers of cases are a reflection of the large amount of testing that the state's doing. What are your thoughts? Do you think that's accurate?
Well, no, there absolutely is some truth to that. I think that the conversation doesn't stop there. Obviously, in any disease, if you look for it more, you will likely find it. And that's the case with coronavirus as well. The more testing we do, the more we'll find it. What it doesn't tell you is the burden of disease. And what I mean by that is in terms of how sick people are getting with it. That's why we look at hospitalization rates. Hospitalization rates really tell us the spread of the disease and the burden of the disease on a specific community. And if you look at the data that's put out by the Arkansas Department of Health, you will see that hospitalization rates in the state of Arkansas continue to climb. We do expect those numbers to also go up in the fall and the winter as those that are older and those with chronic conditions become infected and have to be hospitalized.
Recently on AETN and Arkansas Week, let me read a couple of things for you. Dr. Joe Thompson said this, quote, "We're at the risk of losing control. We've reached 10% positivity rate 5 times in the last 2 weeks. We're seeing 20 to 30% increase in hospitalization and ventilator use over the week." How concerned are you about healthcare being overwhelmed in the state?
You know, I'll say this. I think that we're fortunate, certainly here in Northeast Arkansas, I'll say this, and I believe it's probably a regional approach. The hospitals in Northeast Arkansas, I feel, are prepared. I think that they are meeting frequently and discussing surge plans. I know that each hospital has their own surge plan. I think Dr. Thompson's point is well taken, and I think that we should certainly have these plans in place to be able to deal with large numbers of sick individuals from COVID-19 or the coronavirus. But I do feel comfortable about our hospitals just here in Jonesboro, St. Bernard's Medical Center and NEA Baptist Medical Center. Those are our two referral centers, largest hospitals here in the region. And I feel that they are prepared to be able to take care of it. And there are plans in place in the event we need to look at other options to be able to manage this pandemic in case it does get as dire as it's predicted.
And with that, how do hospitals move forward if you have these continuing surges across the state? I guess trying to get prepared for, you don't want a worst case scenario, if you know what I'm trying to say. How do you start moving toward that, knowing that a larger increase is coming probably in the fall?
Right. So just I'll give you just a brief look on the inside of the hospital side in terms of some of the conversations that are likely going on. You start looking at places within your hospital that maybe you don't typically use as an intensive care bed, but can be converted into that. You start talking about things really that came up in the Northeast when we've got one ventilator. Is there a way that we can serve two patients with one ventilator? And there are. There was, you know, the necessity that occurred in the Northeast during that brought out a lot of inventions, so to speak. And so there are, you know, splitters that allow two patients to be used by one ventilator, the PPE conservation and being able to utilize PPE for a longer period of time and still remain safe in terms of its use. Like I said, the retrofitting of different rooms and areas to be able to take care of more critical patients. I feel strongly that all of our hospitals in this region have undertaken that and have made those plans and are preparing for kind of the worst case scenario.
With the with what's taking place, do you think the state needs to change any approaches on combating COVID-19, or what do you think? And I know this is a difficult thing because you really, you know, this is something we've never dealt with before. And I think that overall, I know you've said in the past, you've been very complimentary of the Department of Health, the governor, and that. What do you think? You think it's a targeted approach works, regional? What is your thoughts on how they're doing so far?
I'll reiterate this, and you're right. I think the governor, I think Dr. Nate Smith, the Arkansas Department of Health, I think has done a great job. I'll just be blunt. I think we're playing the hand we were dealt is what I think is going on. And I think that obviously as you have cases and outbreaks in certain areas of the state, you may approach that area differently. There may be different things that are done in that area that's not done in other areas. Eventually, you will see spread of the virus throughout the state. It just doesn't start there overnight. It's not that the state of Arkansas suddenly has, you know, several thousand cases of COVID. It's that you have a few cases here, then it moves to a few hundred cases there, and it kind of grows based on population density. And so I expect we'll continue to see that, and I expect that the measures that will be put in place will be specific to those geographic areas. But for the most part, yes, I think Arkansas Department of Health has done a great job considering that we've never been down this road before and that we're still kind of learning as we go.
And I guess what has to be challenging, Dr. Spites, by the way, Dr. Shane Spites is joining us from NYIT. the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. What has to be a challenge is that you work on something, but you really probably don't know until after 14 days whether that approach is working or not. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, it's even longer than that, Jonathan, but you're spot on. So really what happens is when we look at an intervention, it can take 4 to 6 weeks to see if that intervention really made a difference. You may start seeing a trend within a week or two, but in terms of really saying, okay, did this make an impact? Unfortunately, you're probably 4 to 6 weeks away. I mean, it goes both ways. It goes whether we're talking about a loosening of restrictions, whether we're talking about a tightening of restrictions. When we just look back at the short time period this pandemic has played out, and we see when shelter at home orders were put in place in cities and states that did that, the trend in cases continued to go up for a period of several weeks after that was in place, because it took that long for the infections to die down and plateau off. And so this is certainly one of those scenarios where a decision or a regulation or whatever it is that's put in place, you're not going to see the effects immediately.
Let's go to some questions real fast on Facebook. Kelly, he asks this question, Kelly does. Dr. Spites, you've mentioned before that you thought there would initially be a surge of COVID-19 cases in Central Arkansas, the Northwest Arkansas, followed by Northeast Arkansas. The first two have happened, so do you believe our surge in cases will be happening soon, meaning in Northeast Arkansas?
Yes, I do. I do believe that. And again, it goes back to population density and proximity of one person to another. And so that would be the natural progression, just as we've seen. I don't believe, though, we will hit, which is the most concerning piece, I don't believe that we'll hit exponential spread until into the fall when the schools reopen. And again, there's more opportunity for the virus to spread from person to person. Here in Craighead County in Northeast Arkansas, we are seeing an increase in cases now. You know, for some people, that was a surprise because I think they tried to liken it to what the 1918 Spanish influenza did. Remember, this is not the same virus. This is a coronavirus, and that was an influenza virus. And those viruses, though we try to compare them, they're two very different viruses and do act differently. I think many people were hopeful that our cases would have dropped significantly over the summer. I think there's a combination of reasons why that didn't happen. One of them is that we started to really reduce social distancing mandates and regulations right at the beginning of the summer. So people that had been largely at home or confined to certain spaces were now wanting to and got out and about and moved around. And again, that's the way the virus is spread, is person to person. So that's probably one of the big contributing factors as to why we haven't seen a significant decline over the summer.
Here's another good question that he asks. Does the lower mortality rate for COVID-19 mean that we should not worry about getting infected?
Now, so the mortality rate or the case fatality rate, that actually gets complicated. So just bear with me here. And I'll go through some numbers on this. So ideally, when we talk about that, we're talking about the number of deaths divided by the total number of those infected. But we know that our current number of infected is actually much higher than what we're tracking through positive cases. So when we say here in the state of Arkansas, we've got, 30,000 cases, we know that it's much higher than that. And depending on who you listen to, is it 5 times higher? Is it 10 times higher? The bottom line, though, when we talk about mortality rate, it depends on your age. So the older you are, the more likely you are to die from the virus. The rate goes up as you get older, even if you're healthy. So looking at the CDC mortality data, let's just say for those aged 25 to 34, it shows a 0.67% mortality rate. And you say, well, that's not bad. That's less than 1%. Well, I want to remind the listeners, the seasonal influenza mortality rate is 0.1%. And we have hundreds of thousands of people die every year from seasonal influenza. That's a 0.1%. But for COVID-19, for individuals aged 65 to 74, right now the CDC says it's a 20% mortality rate. Now, even if that number's off by a factor of 10, and we look at both those numbers, that still means that a 25 to 34-year-old has a mortality rate of 0.06% or 0.07%, close to 0.1. And then the older individuals, 65 to 74, have a 2% mortality rate. A 2% mortality rate is very high. That is very high for a respiratory spread illness. When we talk about Spanish influenza, it was much lower than that. And again, as a reminder, seasonal influenza is about a 0.1% mortality rate. And so the mortality rate, the answer is it depends. It depends on your age. On average, depending on what you're reading, we're talking about for the whole population between a 1 to a 0.8 is probably, 1 to a 0.5 mortality rate is what we're seeing. But that too, that data is just going to have to, we're waiting for all that to play out. As the pandemic continues, we get better and better data. So we'll be able to, I hate to say that, we'll know for sure by the time this is over, but that doesn't necessarily help anybody right now.
You're listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers. I'm Jonathan Reeves. A lot of questions about school starting back, colleges, universities, public schools. We're going to address that in the next segment. That's coming up. You're listening to KASU, streaming live on KASU.org, also on the new KASU app. Back with more next. This is COVID-19 Questions and Answers on KASU. I'm News Director Jonathan Reeves. My guest this hour, Dr. Shane Spites, who's the Dean of NYIT's College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. Dr. Spites, thank you so much for your time as always. We appreciate you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan. Happy to be here.
So we talked with our friend Kelly here just a few minutes ago, who had some excellent questions about COVID-19. He had some more questions. Also, Mark has some questions. These are about going back to school in the fall, both at Arkansas State and also in public schools. First of all, Kelly asks this question. Do you think that schools and universities that reopen for face-to-face classes will have to shut down or transition to virtual classes in the fall? Is that a possibility?
I'll say, based on the current data that I have looked at and the current information that's out there in terms of the national models, coupled with what we're seeing, again, from the most recent models coming from the state, I absolutely believe that schools will close early this fall, both public schools and colleges and universities. I think the big question is when, and when would that trigger be? But I don't think there's any doubt. And in fact, there are many states and school districts and areas that are planning for early closures. I'll just speak to NYIT. Our plans right now are not to have our students return after they leave for the Thanksgiving break. So once our NYIT students leave for the Thanksgiving break, they're not to be back on campus until sometime mid-January. And so we'll make a decision in December whether we'll extend that or not. And I feel like many universities, colleges, and different school systems are also looking at those opportunities.
Do you think there's a certain threshold or percentage of infections at which point you'd recommend ending those face-to-face classes at schools or universities?
So it's really going to be variable, and it's going to be different for every community, and it depends on the kind of community spread that you're seeing. So in terms of, let's just take here for Jonesboro, for example, let's say we have a nursing home outbreak, an unfortunate nursing home outbreak where you've got 50 cases. That wouldn't necessarily mean that Jonesboro Public Schools or Valley View or ASU should close. However, if we start seeing 50 cases in the community, and there's no relationship at all and no known source, and it seems like these are starting to be community spread, that would be more concerning. And so I think each institution has to look at their resources in terms of what their capabilities are to keep students safe. And I think that's going to have to be an individual decision by that institution. I can assure you this, just in my conversations with educational institutions in Northeast Arkansas, I feel that the vast majority of them are making appropriate plans on how to, again, protect faculty, staff, and students, and also those decisions in terms of when to close. It's going to be different for every institution, though it wouldn't surprise me, to be honest with you, if we see something similar like we did this spring, where it's kind of a domino and all of the schools begin to close at one time. That would probably be due to community spread, depending on what's going on in that area. Now, it may be that we don't close as a state. It may be that you see Central Arkansas school districts close first, again, followed by Northwest and then Northeast, and maybe it's dictated by viral spread. That would probably be more of an appropriate approach, is what I would think, because I don't think anyone denies It is better for kids to be in school. It is better to be in school, getting an education, and staying in that system. The question is, how long is it safe to keep them in that system before you've done more harm than good in terms of spread of the virus?
And kind of piggybacking off that, Mark asked this question. It's a two-part question. One, is it safe to send our kids back to school? And two, are there safeguards that can be put in place to educate our kids while also protecting them, teachers, and their families?
So in terms of it being safe, I do feel like that the school systems are taking the appropriate measures and following CDC and Arkansas Department of Health guidance in terms of, okay, and this is the precaution they should be taking. When we have a positive case, how do we react? When a case is positive in this school room, how do we handle that? When a staff member is positive, how do we do that? So it's not if, it's when. And those are the questions that need to be asked, really, in all school districts and all educational institutions. And again, I feel very comfortable with my conversations that I've had with the school districts that I've spoken to and the educational institutions that I've spoken to, that those plans are being made to make sure that the students are safe. There are plans in terms of virtual school. I think everybody recognizes that. And just going through this last spring, we've had lessons learned from that. So we know what works and we know what doesn't. So I do feel comfortable in terms of what the plans are at this point on the educational side.
It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when infections will take place in schools. How should schools react to infections to prevent large outbreaks?
Well, and you're right, it's not a matter of if and when. So in terms of how they manage that, I would expect that each one of them has a protocol or a procedure in place in terms of how they do that. And really that can be simply done through adopting some of the guidance that's been put out by CDC and the Department of Health through a flow diagram. So basically it can be, and it will be simple. It should include not only a positive case, but a presumptive positive. And what I mean by that is the student has signs or symptoms that are classic for COVID or coronavirus infection. We know that the testing is not where it needs to be, and I don't expect that testing to improve as cases continue to rise in across the country and in our state. And so we need to be ready to shift to illness-based symptoms in terms of diagnosis. And so I think most of the schools are looking at that. I think it was great that the governor delayed the start of school year to give schools more time to prepare and create those protocols.
So going back to Arkansas State for a second, how will you and NYIT be working with Arkansas State as we go through the fall and infections are sure to rise?
Now, I can tell you right now that NYIT is working very closely with Arkansas State on plans on how to effectively diagnose and trace infections on the ASU campus. Not to toot our own horns, but it's very fortunate that ASU has an NYIT physician clinic and the medical school sitting, right in the middle of campus during this time. This is certainly a time we've got proud of our staff and our faculty. We've got Dr. Carl Abraham, infectious disease specialist. We have, pediatricians, family physicians. We've got multiple individual faculty that are versed in this. We've got research faculty. Our dean of research has actually studied this virus in the past. And so I think it's fortunate that ASU has NYIT here to actually help through this pandemic. I think that's an added asset for them. And we're happy to be here. I want to be clear. We love the partnership with ASU.
We're happy you're here too, for sure. And it's great to be able to have you all there for that partnership and also to make programs like these possible. Let's talk for a minute about public schools and universities and sports. There's a lot of people who want to see sports in the fall, but do you think it's safe for athletes to play sports in the fall? How can that happen in the COVID-19 atmosphere?
You know, when we talk about, and I've gotten this question before, when we talk about athletics or even band or, choir, or any of these kind of extracurricular group activities, they all present their own challenges when you talk about how do you do that, or if you do that, or can you do that. And I'm not trying to sidestep it, but right now it's just too early to tell. It's too early to know what's going to be feasible in August. And I realize that Dr. Spice, that doesn't help me. We've got to practice and we've got to get ready for a season or things like that. I'm afraid that, it's just the way it is. And as with many aspects of the virus, we really need to see where we are about 2 weeks before that planned event. And again, I know that that's hard when you say we're talking about a whole football season. But at the end of the day, this is a global pandemic, and we don't always get to have it our way during a global pandemic. Sometimes, you know, we have to make adjustments, and we have to do with what we can and what we know.
When you're dealing with a close contact sport like football, how can those sports be played safely to minimize risk of infections? I don't know if you can answer this or not, but I hope you know what I'm trying to ask here.
No, I do. And there are actually initiatives, you know, being tried around the country to lower the risk already, certainly among college athletes. And whether it be that they're testing all of the college athletes upon return and then testing them regularly. Because, I mean, if you have, let's just take, for example, we get 10 athletes together and we know for a fact that they are negative. Now, if we can control who they come in contact with, then you pretty much put them, you pretty much isolated them in a bubble. Well, I mean, yeah, they could work out and practice together. That's certainly an option. Now, I will say this, I'm familiar with several professional soccer teams that are doing that right now. And just from what I'm hearing, those soccer players are finding it very tough to be isolated from their friends and their family because they're basically in a quarantine situation. Even though they're not sick, they're trying to stay away from anybody who could possibly infect them, and then they would infect their teammates. I think it's way too early to talk about actually canceling a season. I think we've just got to kind of wait and see. But there are some interesting things that are being done around the country to try to allow that to move forward.
Let's talk about the data real fast. You said that as we go into the fall, numbers could really, you know, spike up. And you had said earlier that UAMS had a projected had some project models. Can we talk about the data a little bit as to what you all are fearing could be a reality as we get into the fall, please?
So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So in terms of the report, the UAMS School of Public Health report that came out July the 2nd, I'll say that prior to reading that report, I was concerned about what the national models were showing for this fall and winter. And I'd anticipated we would see an increase in cases higher than we're seeing and have seen to this point. However, I was not prepared to see the prediction that was in the UAMS study and in their paper. And just to quote a piece of that, in quotes, on October 30th, if nothing changes, we should expect 150,000 active cases in the state and a forecast of 20,000 daily new infections by the end of September. Now, to put that into perspective, right now here in the state of Arkansas, we have about 6,500 active cases. So about 6,500 active cases. This model is predicting 150,000 active cases. And just again, to put it in perspective, right now we average about 500 cases a day. And this model is forecasting 20,000 cases per day. That's significant. I was really surprised at first, but when I sat down and I think about the numbers behind this, a state of 3 million people, and our numbers show that we've got about 30,000 cases, means that only 1% of our state has been infected by this virus. That's a virus with no vaccine, no effective treatment, no adequate rapid testing. And so even if we're off by tenfold and say, look, it's really 10 times that number that's out there, that still only means that 10% of our state population has been infected. Which means that 90% of the population would likely get infected before, or has the potential, to get infected before a vaccine is available. When I go through those numbers, it makes the UAMS model more plausible.
You're listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers. I'm Jonathan Reeves. We'll return with our guest, Dr. Shane Spites. You're listening to KASU, streaming live on KASU.org. Welcome back to COVID-19 Questions and Answers on 91.9 FM, KASU. I'm News Director Jonathan Reeves. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson has issued an order requiring people to wear masks in public through the state, which, of course, the state's dealing with the surge in coronavirus cases that we've been talking about. The Republican governor issued the order on Thursday after weeks of resisting such a requirement. His decision, of course, will take effect on Monday, and it follows growing support from businesses and health leaders. So setting all that up, Dr. Spites, there has still been some concern about a little bit of confusion about the language from earlier on. And Mark asks this question about that. You know, that there's been some concern about whether masks were needed, whether masks were not, because at the very beginning of all of this, people were saying don't wear masks, and it was probably just so people could have plenty of PPE, and now they're saying masks are required. There's been a lot of confusion in that, and before the mandate was passed on Thursday, there was a lot of people, especially in the city of Jonesboro, it was a heated debate as to whether or not masks were really necessary. So I know this is a long setup for this question, but kind of explain to us, Dr. Spites, about this, about why there was such confusing and conflicting language, it appeared to be, at the very beginning to where it is now, and do masks actually work in this, just to help clear up any confusion.
So it's actually kind of difficult to find, but it's there. The data's there and the research is there if you're willing to take the deep dive and truly find it. But people have to be willing to look and understand what they read, because we're talking about research data that speaks to things like number needed to treat, statistical significance. You have to be able to recognize studies that are underpowered. You have to be able to look at things that are extrapolated. And so that can be difficult for just the average person to pull a research article and start reading it. First of all, the type of mask matters. When we talk about the research, there's different masks out there that have been researched. The N95 mask is a mask that's used by healthcare workers, and that's largely used to protect them from getting sick or getting infected if they're around somebody that's sick. The surgical mask, that's what we used. I used it when I was in the operating room and performed surgery, and I used that to protect me from getting fluids and things onto my face or into my mouth so that I would get infected by a patient. The cloth mask, which is where the heated debate comes from that your listener referred to, there's not as much evidence. There is more evidence than there was, and we've been able to look at different types of materials that are used for cloth masks and done some laboratory and observational studies to get better understanding. But to be honest with you, the data that I pulled in terms of cloth masks, it is clear that in the research that I've looked at, they do reduce the spread of the virus for those who are infected and do not know it. It can provide some protection to the wearer from getting the virus, though that's not as clear. Now, in terms of the conflicting messages that were coming out by healthcare institutions and experts, in terms of when that happened and what happened there, that was when cases in our country were very low. And the need for surgical and N95 masks by healthcare workers was a concern, and we didn't need everybody going out, and it still is a concern. We didn't need everybody going out and actually buying those off the shelf, because our hospitals and our clinics and our front line need that. That's still a shortage. We still have need for N95 masks. It is still very difficult right now for hospitals and clinics to get N95 masks for their frontline staff. We are still having to go through cleaning procedures and UV radiation procedures to try to disinfect those masks to be used multiple times, which is something that I think we never thought we would have to do even just a year ago. But in terms of the data and the evidence on the soft cloth mask, again, I point back to the UAMS prediction from the School of Public Health. They did include that in their modeling, and from their prediction, they saw at least a 60% reduction in the number of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths that could be achieved if you had the majority of the population wearing a soft cloth mask.
So how do we clear up any of the confusion for the public? Because I know there's a lot of information out there.
I'll just kind of boil it down. The cloth masks that work best are the 70-30 cotton blend mask with three layers or more. So in terms of all of the different research articles that came out, if you were going to make your own cloth mask or you were going to buy one commercially available, you would want to make sure it's at least three layers thick or more. And it is a 70-30 blend, cotton blend. That seemed to be the most effective in producing protection. What we know is that the individual that is sick and doesn't know it, as they breathe it out, that virus is attached to their respiratory droplets, which are basically small microscopic water droplets that hold the virus. that can travel up to 6 feet. It wasn't that we made up the 6 foot rule. There's a reason behind that. If you put the mask on, now all of a sudden it can't travel outside of your mask. And so it's much less likely to infect somebody. The other piece that people need to recognize is the wearing of the cloth mask is in addition to the social distancing recommendations. It's not in lieu of. So it's not that now that I've got a cloth mask on, I can stand right next to somebody and we can talk more closely. If you still have the ability to be 6 feet away, you should use that. It's just another layer of protection. Again, as we're preparing for the cases that we think we'll see this fall, we're looking through all the different avenues we can for the public to be able to protect themselves and those around them.
And I think also we've talked about this before, but just very quickly, wearing the mask appropriately, and what we mean is correctly, properly, is just about as important as wearing the mask itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen that time and time again. The mask, it does not need to be, nor should it be tight fitting. A soft cloth mask does not need to be tight fitting. An N95 mask does, and an N95 mask, you actually have to be measured to make sure it fits you. Not so with a cloth mask. The cloth mask should cover your nose and your mouth underneath your chin, but it should be somewhat loose on the sides to allow airflow back and forth. Again, the idea behind it is you're creating a physical barrier in front of your face that can catch the respiratory droplets that the virus is bound up into so that you don't infect someone else around you if you happen to be sick and not know it.
Let's talk about Arkansas and testing supplies and those things. Much of the nation, of course, seeing high rises of COVID-19. How do you think Arkansas is doing by way of having enough testing materials to do tests, supplies? Is there a concern about running out of supplies and PPE and those questions? And there's a lot of people who've been wondering about, okay, we're having this now. Are we going to be ready for these rising cases in the fall?
So let's talk about the testing right now. In terms of testing, we would love to be at the point where you or I could walk into any clinic in the state, or certainly in Jonesboro or Craighead County, and get tested. And if I wanted to walk back again tomorrow and get tested again, I could do that. And then my results would be, you know, resulted to me within a timely fashion, ideally within a day or so. And that you could have that happen in all the hospitals as well. And that's just not the case, unfortunately, because here's what happens. That's a finite resource. And right now across the country, we have states that are having surging cases. Specifically, we talk about Florida, California, Texas, Arizona. They're seeing significant spikes in their cases. Resources are being diverted to those states that are being pulled from other states. And what I mean by that is, it's not uncommon at all for most clinics and hospitals to utilize a third-party reference lab for specialized testing, like COVID testing. And so there are these large third-party vendors that are national vendors that provide these tests to these hospitals and clinics. Whenever there's a large surge in a certain area, resources get diverted to that area. So as you might imagine, there's a whole lot of testing going on in Florida or in Texas or, like I said, California. Well, that chews up resources that we could have here in Arkansas or even here in Jonesboro in terms of testing. We do have testing available. It's intermittent in terms of how quickly you get it back. The testing may not be resulted back for several days or longer, and that's unfortunate. I do believe that as the pandemic continues and as we see cases increase this fall, there will continue to be a shortage of testing. Right now, to my knowledge, there is no magic bullet that's going to come out that basically fixes our testing problem that we have here in the country. We are still very much dependent upon the RT-PCR testing, which is a laboratory-based testing, which takes a while to run and to result out. We still don't have adequate rapid testing or the quick turnaround that you might get for flu testing or strep or even like a pregnancy test. We don't have those platforms that are readily available. It would be nice to have them. I'm afraid that by the time those become something that's really widely available, we will be in the middle of the pandemic, which is why, as I mentioned earlier, I believe fully that we will be shifting to a symptom-based diagnosis. So we will go through, and if you meet, I'm just going to make this up, if you meet three of these five symptoms, then we're going to diagnose you with COVID-19 because the testing is not where it needs to be, and we have to save it for hospitalized patients.
And that might be challenging if you have a lot of similar of like, say, for example, and I could be wrong on this, but if the flu and COVID-19, for example, have the exact same symptoms, and they may not, but you know, I'm just using this, you know where I'm trying to go with that.
No, I absolutely know where you're coming with. And so let's go ahead and just take that. Let's go down that road. Let's say that the patient comes in and they've got symptoms that are similar to COVID-19, which are also similar to the flu. Remember, I don't have a, I mean, we do have a medication for flu, but we don't have a medication for COVID. Hopefully we would be able to tease out the differences. Now, we could test you for the flu and we could find out whether it's flu or not. And so if it's not the flu, then we could make the presumption that you probably have COVID and then send you down a different road. So in that instance, if we could test you for the flu and then by deduction say that you have COVID. I think I very much see that being utilized. One of the things I'd like to take the opportunity to mention to your listeners, please make sure you get your flu shot this year. Please make sure you get your flu shot. If there was ever a year to get your flu shot, it is this year. And again, as a reminder, don't necessarily get it when it first comes out. You should wait probably until the 1st of October to get it. We have found some evidence. And this is, again, when we talk about emerging evidence, I used to recommend that as soon as it came out, you should get it. If it comes out the 1st of August, you should get your flu shot in August. We are seeing instances where the vaccine was less effective on into the later flu season, which we have seen. And so therefore the recommendation has changed that you should get your flu shot in early October. So I'm just going to use my time to interject that, Jonathan.
Absolutely. And here's a question I hope is not a silly question, but I'll ask it anyway, because I don't mind asking those silly questions. Can you get COVID and flu at the same time?
Yes, absolutely you can. You can actually get two different strains of flu at the same time. You can actually get flu multiple times in the same year because there's different strains of flu. So like the vaccine protects from three or four different strains of the flu, but we do have individuals who've gotten like a flu A, and then bless their hearts, they got over and got a flu B, you know, a month later. So that does happen. Can you get COVID and flu at the same time? Yes, likely you can. Again, when we look at the national modeling, that was one of the concerns. Is that you get influenza, and then on top of that, you get COVID. So when we talk about estimates in terms of hospitalizations and the severity of the disease, that's very concerning for us into the fall and the winter months.
So here's another question here. How do you see testing and contact tracing take place in a university setting during the fall semester? I forget who at Arkansas State asked that, but was really curious about that. And is there a point where during the fall semester, all students may have to be tested as well as faculty and staff? Same thing for public schools. I hope that that I'm asking that correctly. I believe I am. If my way of testing and contact tracing in the area of schools.
So in terms of testing and contact tracing, that'll probably be institution dependent. And so when you say, you know, like how would it work for a public school versus the university or versus ASU, for example? First of all, the universal testing is not a proven idea. Just that there were some schools that thought they would do that, and I think have kind of abandoned it, saying that, hey, we're going to test every single student that comes on campus. What you have to understand, and I'll use the pregnancy test analogy, it's not one of those things that if you're positive, then you know you're positive and that's it. You just may be, you know, or if you're negative, you know you're negative. If you're negative, you're just negative at that time. It doesn't mean that you can't be positive 12 hours later or can't be positive a day later. Now, if you're tested positive and you're asymptomatic, that's a different scenario. Then we would obviously isolate you and anybody you've been in contact with in the prior 48 hours. Within close proximity, but it's just not really a good use of the testing supplies necessarily to do the mass testing. There is something called pool testing, where actually we can use less reagents and test a large number of individuals at once. And so I know that some places are looking at doing that. In terms of contact tracing, that's in combination, or excuse me, in coordination with the Arkansas Department of Health, because COVID-19 is a reportable disease. So we will be doing and working with ASU in terms of contact tracing on this campus. We will be certainly using symptom-based approach as well. And the simple reason is because some of the testing is delayed. So if a student were to show up at the NYIT clinic and they had signs and symptoms of COVID-19, yes, we may go ahead and test you or get you tested, but but we're probably, if we feel good that the diagnosis is COVID, we will go ahead and isolate that individual at that time and talk about who they were been in close proximity with the prior 48 hours. We won't wait for the test to come back. Most contact tracing that you hear about in the state occurs once the test is positive. As you might imagine, if you have to wait 4 or 5 days for the positive test to come back, and that individual that's infected is going around with their normal day-to-day activities, then they could be infecting other people. And that's what we certainly don't want to see on a college campus.
Sally asked this on Facebook. She's worried about her daughter going to choir classes. She's heard a lot about, you know, congregational singing or choir singing or that. Is it safe for schools to have choir and to be able to sing and do that because of concerns with COVID-19?
So when we talk about, you know, any of these places, you know, going to any of these places, it, you know, for the most part, it's relatively safe to go most places as long as the CDC and ADH guidelines are being followed. And that means that everyone's 6 feet apart at all times and everyone's wearing masks and decontamination, you know, occurs. You know, when we talk about choirs and singing, that presents a separate problem. The reason why is because, as you might imagine, the lung volume needed that increases in terms of when an individual is singing and they're projecting that air out in front of them. So if they are projecting the air out in front of them and there's an audience that's within proximity, then the choir could be spreading the virus, or an individual choir member who is sick and doesn't know it is spreading the virus to their colleagues there in the choir or in the audience. And so there have even been several outbreaks here in the state of Arkansas that have actually been centered around singing events or choir events. And so that does represent a different issue, as does, we'll say, band, you know, in terms of blowing through instruments and blowing through those in close proximity in a band room. I'm not talking about out on a football field where you're certainly more than 6 feet apart, but in a confined, closed space, anytime that you can have an infected individual potentially spread the virus around through blowing, sneezing, coughing, singing, that sort of thing, there's a risk for spread of the virus. And so those individual instances have to be looked at individually to say, look, what can we really do? Is it that the band has to practice outside, or they have to practice separated in a large indoor, you know, convention center? You know, how there are typically ways that you can mitigate that risk. You just have to be creative.
Jennifer asks this question: what are the effects of smoking and the virus, and how could it affect the Clean Indoor Air Act? I think there may be some exemptions possibly in there, but you know, really worried about those who smoke and COVID-19. I know we said lung problems are a huge issue. We've heard about people who've had diabetes and other things, but not a lot of talk about smoking. Can we talk about that for a few minutes?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that question up, because very early on, and I was watching this, very early on, there was some data, or there were some thoughts coming out in some publications that said that smoking might offer protection from COVID. Like it actually might have a protective effect. Very intrigued by that. And I, you know, as a physician, obviously, I was going to be skeptical because of that, but I was willing to listen to the evidence and see where it led. That quickly turned out to be false. And actually now, as we've looked back at that data and the culmination of new data, the opposite is true. And I'll just say this. There was an article that came out yesterday in the Journal of Adolescent Health that was published that looked at young smokers. And they were twice as likely to end up with severe COVID disease as opposed to their non-smoking peers. There were some researchers at the University of Rochester Medical Center in New York that looked at the ACE2 receptor, which is the receptor that the virus uses to infiltrate or get into human cells, specifically the lung cells, and then start reproducing and replicating. Smoking increases the level of those receptors, thus increasing the ability of COVID to enter the lungs and create more disease. And so that just came out as well. So the other thing to remember is long-term smokers typically have lung damage already. And this is a respiratory virus that likes to live in the lungs and likes to reproduce in the lungs. So if you're an individual who already has trouble breathing due to long-term smoking, COVID-19 will worsen that for you. And so that's the evolving evidence that we're seeing now in terms of cigarette smoking and COVID-19.
Before I let you run, thank you for your time as always. Anything else you want to add that we may not have gotten to, or are there any final words that you have for today?
You know, I can't think of anything. I think that I would encourage your listeners to continue to educate themselves, you know, read the research, read the data, make sure that you're up on the trends in terms of where cases are heading or where hospitalizations are heading in your area specifically. That will be the biggest indicator of, you know, when do we think things would shut down again, or when do we think things would close, or, you know, are things getting worse in my area? So those are the trends, and those can easily be found on Arkansas Department of Health website. There are lots of different places where you can track state and local data. So I'd encourage your listeners to be following that, certainly as we enter into the fall and winter months.
And we'll be talking with you, Dr. Spites, a lot more as we go on, a lot more frequently as cases continue to rise as we go into the fall. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate you so much. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Johnson. Thank you for having me.
And that's Dr. Shane Spites, Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. You've been listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers on KASU. Thanks for listening.